Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You're listening to A Slice of Cheese with Jenny Linford on Food FM. Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Tesco, Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Asda, Morrisons, Ocado, Amazon and specialist food retailers.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Hello, welcome to A Slice of Cheese, the Food FM radio series that celebrates the world of cheese. I'm Jenny Linford, a food writer and cheese enthusiast, the author of Great British Cheeses. Cheese is a delicious and fascinating food, and we're setting out to explore this remarkable food and share the stories of the people who make, sell and love it. This week on A Slice of Cheese, I explore the idea of regenerative farming and the cheese scene. Neal's Yard Dairy's Bronwyn Percival, co-author of Reinventing the Wheel, shares her insights. I also talked to Lee Truelove, head of regenerative farming at First Milk, a dairy cooperative, and Leona MacDonald, business unit director at Golden Hooves, First Milk's cheese company.
Online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
This week on A Slice of Cheese, we're looking at regenerative farming and cheese. I'm very happy to have with me today Bronwyn Percival, who's the technical director and author of a book, a fascinating book, called Reinventing the Wheel. Hello, Bronwyn.
Hi, Jenny.
Bronwyn, I always enjoy talking with you because I always learn so much. I have sort of noticed this phrase of regenerative farming being used, and I was actually thought perhaps we could start with thinking, what does that word mean? Are there concrete? I mean, I don't think it has a legal definition, so, but there are definitely ideas attached to it. That's my impression. tell me your thoughts.
You know, it's a really interesting question. And I think the easiest way to think about it in some ways is that regenerative farming is a little bit like artisan cheese. It's a word that lots of people use and understand in different ways. And because it's so poorly defined, it can be applied to just about anything if you set your mind to it. And I think that's one of the beauties of it, because in many ways it's quite inclusive, but it's also one of its Achilles heels, because what at the end does it really mean?
Fascinating. That's really, really interesting. One of the reasons I wanted to look at it on the podcast is that, you know, I've noticed cheesemakers, when they talk to me, talk about how they're trying to farm regeneratively and they're making conscious efforts. So I'm guessing there are concrete things that farmers do or try and do that they feel are, you know, are regenerative. And in fact, the idea of soil seems to, and the sort of the health of soil has been mentioned to me.
Yeah, the whole ideology behind regenerative agriculture is entirely laudable. I mean, it's hard to take issue with anything that is about doing things which ultimately regenerate ecological systems rather than deplete them, which I think fundamentally is the broadest definition of regenerative agriculture. Mm-hmm. How you do that and how you get there is entirely down to the user. And as I said, it's one of the things that make the movement so attractive and so inclusive to many people. But if you walk around, for example, the Groundswell Festival, which has become deservedly more and more popular over the last few years as it's been running, you recognize that there's everything there from tiny dairy producers who are PFLA certified organic and, you know, feed no grain whatsoever and are really focused on livestock use as a way of putting carbon into soil and taking very little out, all the way to, you know, big biotech firms that will use their technology to help you, you know, deliver whatever, you know, whatever results you want. And again, I'm saying this not as an anti-science person. In fact, I like to think of myself as an entirely pro-science and pro-technology person. But it's interesting to think about the rhetorical use of the word regenerative and the way in which that has such power with consumers. And just really, it's got to the point now where when I hear someone say that they're farming regeneratively, I want to ask more questions and not take that at face value, because sometimes I think it travels, that statement can, in the wrong hands, travel dangerously close to greenwashing.
Yes, that was exactly what I was thinking. I mean, I think it's just interesting that, as you say, when something becomes desirable and it's not defined particularly, or it's got a very broad definition, then it's raised to say you're doing it. New Zealand Dairy, notably, you work very closely with the cheesemakers whose cheeses you stock and sell. So have you noticed yourself among the cheesemakers, are you noting interest and desire to farm regeneratively? And are some people taking steps to go down that road? Do you see specific examples?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, again, I know that regenerative farming is the topic of this podcast, and we're going to keep coming back to it, but I don't like that word. And I think the interesting, I'm just going to come out and say it. I think the interesting thing is, if you ask the question, are the farmers that we're working with and the cheesemakers who are buying milk for the cheeses they're making to sell to us, are they actively participating in a conversation about what good dairy farming looks like? And by good, I mean progressive and environmentally friendly. Absolutely. That conversation is very, very front and center within the groups of, you know, groups of cheesemakers that we're moving within. At the same time, what that really looks like is really down to the individual and how much progress they're making on those fronts and what fronts they want to make progress on and what's appropriate for each of their systems is wildly different from one farm to the other. And I'm not saying that in a way to, you know, I'm aware that every time I talk about the farms that we work with generally, I'm at risk of greenwashing what we're doing, because it's a mosaic. And I wouldn't say we have complete transparency about all the farming processes that are used by all of the farmers who supply us, even though we know them and we, you know, visit them very, very frequently, as you know, because you've come along with us. Okay. And we've been working with many of them for, you know, almost 40 years. So, you know, it's a real challenge. And I think in some ways, in our relationship with our suppliers, we are playing the role of the consumer. And we're not farming experts. We're trying to learn more and more about farming, and I think we're making progress. But at the end of the day, I'm not a farmer, and I don't claim that I have farming knowledge or understanding of all the different factors that are going into the choices that these people in massively different places, working with different kinds of animals, different systems, different farms, different climates, are all facing when they're trying to make the decisions about how best to run their farm. And the challenge for us is to take this very, very complex information that's coming to us in bits and bobs and systematize it and communicate it to our customers in a way that's honest and transparent, and hopefully lets people who really put environmental questions at the front of their decision-making, hopefully gives them the tools they need to make the best decisions for them. And that's a big challenge. And yeah, it's a big challenge. And we're doing some things to try to address that, which I'm happy to talk about.
Yeah.
But I just, I'd love to say that all of our farmers are regenerative and, you know, they're all, you know, sitting under this umbrella and we're all happy. But like, I think it's incumbent upon us as people who are working within the dairy industry to take a much more complex, granular and problematic view of things and really, you know, tell it like it is, even when that truth is complex and maybe not as like, you know, perfect as we'd like it to be.
That is a very good point, Bronwyn. I mean, it's very interesting, and that's partly why I wanted you on this episode. So what are some of the things that you're seeing? Some of these initiatives, some of these gaze, this idea of looking after the environment. I think that must be part of regenerative farming. Do you see that in the farmers you're working with, the cheesemakers you work with, who often are farmhouse cheesemakers? What are things that you see that perhaps, you know, because over all these years, Bronwyn, you must see changes, that people are perhaps bringing in a new approach, perhaps they're more aware of things. Is that, perhaps we could go down that road. That might be a constructive, you know, interesting road to go down.
Yeah. I mean, I think one place to look is, you know, which of our producers are accredited against different schemes. So, you know, there are different audits that people can undertake and accreditation schemes that they can be part of. The most obviously one of those is sort of Soil Association organic mm-hmm. accreditation. And to be honest, over the time I've been working at Neilshire Dairy, so the last 20 years, we probably are buying from less organically accredited producers than ever before.
Right.
Which doesn't necessarily make me happy, because I think while the organic certification itself isn't perfect, it's one scheme. And in some cases, it's a bit, you know, it's a bit individualistic, but I'm not convinced that organic farming is necessarily the best in every capacity in terms of its environmental impact. It's interesting because it's audited, and because if somebody says they're organic, you do know exactly what they're doing, and you know what they're not doing in terms of fertilizers, in terms of pesticides, in terms of how much grain they're giving their animals. I mean, those are all important questions.
Yeah.
And I like the fact that a scheme like organic really says, you know, you know what it's doing because it's been checked by a third party.
Yeah.
PFLA, Pasture for Life, is an organization that is really focused on promoting the benefits of animals that are fed entirely on forage, by which I mean not grain, not starchy foods, but actual grass, hay, silage, the sorts of things that ruminants actually are designed to ruminate rather than to digest like a person. Mm-hmm. And you can say that actually there are big environmental benefits and nutritional benefits potentially that are associated with Pasture for Life standards. And I think there are a few cheesemakers coming in on the margins who are working within PFLA standards, whether or not they're accredited. I think many of them are. We don't buy any of those cheeses yet. I'm very interested in talking with people and potentially working with people who are. But I think at this point, in terms of the dairy industry in particular, where the animals have been bred to give enormous amounts of milk, the dairy industry is very grain dependent. Mm. And when I say grain, I mean everything from sort of the cake that's fed into the parlor to starchy whole crop silage that contains a lot of carbohydrate and is very, you know, high energy. And, you know, that doesn't suit the Pasture for Life standards. And I kind of agree that it's a problem to which we're dependent on grain feeding for these animals, because they can't thrive if they're not fed this super high energy diet to maintain really high yields. And again, some producers that we're working with are working with different breeds of animals or breeding towards less high production animals and running different systems. And I feel like that's a very incremental change. You can't just, for the most part, I mean, some people have the financial resources to sell all their cows and buy an entirely new herd, but I've never heard of that happening before. And I don't think it should be the expectation that people change their farming systems on a dime. But I think gradually working in a way that makes us less reliant on grain, even if people are never going to reach the, you know, Pasture for Life standard, is an interesting conversation and one that, you know, we're keeping tabs on. I think the final place that's quite interesting and we're spending a lot of time on at the moment is really looking at alternative ways of measuring and reporting about the complex farming systems that our producers are working with. And we partnered with the Sustainable Food Trust Global Farm Metric project, which is a tool that they've developed to allow farmers, not just dairy farmers or not just pastoral farmers, but farmers in any system across the world, to report their farming metrics across 10 different sort of areas, which includes things like soil health, but also, you know, water course management, economic sustainability, biodiversity, you know, the community outputs, you know, the community services that they're providing to the regions where they are. So quite a complex and rich tool, and one that, because the Sustainable Food Trust is run by Patrick Holden, who is ultimately a farmer who makes, you know, whose farm makes Havid cheese, I think designed hopefully with the interests and the needs of farmers in mind. So we're partnering with them to run a trial over the first half of 2024, where farmhouse cheesemakers, whom we buy from, are invited to participate, fill out the tool, and we can actually begin to compare apples with apples with real data to see what the farming systems of our suppliers look like, and to see how they compare with national averages, compare with one another, how far out the outliers in terms of systems are within that group of farmers. But then also, I'm very interested in thinking about how we can use that information in a positive way for communication across our supply chain to hook up our customers who are interested in particular things, whether they're animal welfare, biodiversity, carbon footprint, whatever, of the cheeses, with the information they need to make decisions and think about how we can do that online, in our shops, through wholesale routes and so forth, using the data we get from this trial.
Interesting. Are you finding a good response? Are your cheesemakers prepared to take part?
I think people have been very open-minded so far. We've done an informational session where we go through the contours of the trial with with specialists from the Global Farmmetric team. And I would say everyone's interested in hearing more. I think the proof is going to be in how many of them complete the metric, because it does take, about 8 hours of collection and data entry. And that's a big ask of our suppliers, to be honest. Yeah. And a lot of them spend a lot of time filling out forms for all sorts of people. So I'm aware that what we're asking them to do is going to take them time and resources. Yeah. But I also think that what we have potentially to gain could be well worth it. Yeah. And I'm hopeful that we're going to get enough of a data set that we can start to experiment with using it for communications.
So how long would that period last? I mean, is it done over weeks or months, that collecting of information?
It's done using data gathered over the entire course of a year, but it's the kind of data that most farms are gathering anyway.
Right.
In terms of number of animals, size of the farm, basic metrics.
Right.
But when it's particular to production values and so forth, that data is covered over the course of the year. So they'll be looking for the most part at data about 2023 production, and then the wildlife and so forth surveys that they're going to be doing will all be done over the course of a short period between the beginning of April and the end of June.
Right. I mean, that's interesting. And that takes resources, doesn't it? I mean, it's exactly what Wayne, you were saying about organic, organic is expensive for food producers because you're paying for that certification, and that takes time and money. And that's exactly what you're saying with this, in a way that this, you need resources, don't you? If you're going to make claims, they have to be backed up and checked and audited. And that, as we all know, takes time and resources. So is that something that would farmers have to do that, or would you be able to help them, or how does that go?
So, I mean, in this case, I guess it's important to say that the Global Farmmetric tool is being developed as a free tool for people to use. So unlike, say, Soil Association accreditation or organic audit, they won't be paying they won't be paying to use this tool or to get the information that comes from it. But in terms of resources, it definitely takes time. And what we're, pledging to commit is we're working with a PhD student at the University of Bristol to help a cohort of these farmers actually do those measurements on their farms and fill out the metric. And then we're also going to be holding a series of sort of webinars and drop-in hours for people over the course of that 3-month period, so that if they're having trouble or getting stuck, they can ask their questions and really have expert advice and help, so that they aren't just left on their own to fill out a spreadsheet in a dark room.
You two are putting in a lot of time and energy and effort into this.
I think if it's important to us and we're asking people to do a lot of work, it's the least we can do to do a lot of work ourselves to make it as easy for them as possible and to explain what the benefits are as well. Because I do think that something that's really missing within the cheese industry is this good ability to give customers honest perspective about the supply chains that are providing these cheeses. You walk into our shop and you look across the counter and you have absolutely no ability to see the difference between a cheese that's made in a factory and one that's made in tiny quantities on a small farm in the middle of nowhere. And I think actually the difference between those cheeses, is really important to some customers. Not all of them, but I think some of them really care, and some of them would understand the cost difference between those cheeses far better if it were accompanied by a little bit of context. So I think that potentially there will be benefit to the people who participate in this in terms of the work that we're then doing to communicate about those differences across the supply chain. And that's a bit more nebulous, but I think it could be quite powerful.
Interesting. And do you see in America, in other countries, is the idea of regenerative farming being discussed? Are cheesemakers there interested in it or talking about it? Is there a bit of a buzz in a way about it?
Absolutely. I think this is a very much an international phenomenon. And I would say it's interesting in America because America has more massive factory farms than we do here in the UK. But there's also, I would say, a lot more very small, very extensive family farms in the US than there are in the UK,
right,
working in much more progressive ways, possibly, than the average small farmer in the UK is. And so, you know, grass-based production, sort of pasture for life standards, although they don't call it there, they have that there. They have their own certification schemes. But that sort of extremely extensive ruminant agriculture is far more prevalent in the US than it is here. And so I think, you know, the cheese industry, again, for all these structural reasons that dairy cows aren't naturally bred to thrive in extensive low input systems, is, you know, grappling with those questions in different ways. But I would say absolutely, people are thinking about this in the US and France and all sorts of other places.
That's interesting, isn't it? The way that information can be shared now, thanks to the net and the capacity to chat across screens, you know, I'm talking to, you know, cheesemakers around the world, you know, the joys of technology. And you're always someone who's so interested in ideas, Bronwyn, and knowledge. And so is this something that you are enjoying or finding fascinating to look at and observe and track?
Absolutely. I mean, I think really the process of writing Reinventing the Wheel with my husband, Francis, you know, back in 2015, I don't think I was thinking a lot about sustainability questions before we started working on the book. But the more we went and researched and read about the dairy industry and its unintended consequences and the way that it's changed even in the last 50 or 60 years, absolutely blew my mind. And I think that was the point at which I really was awakened to this fact that things have not always been the way they are right now. And in fact, a lot of the way in which farming has progressed has been antithetical to the environment, but also to the quality of cheese. And so it is, I think it's at the very center of my interest in cheese, is this question about going back to farming and asking the question about what good farming for cheese looks like and how that overlaps with good farming for the planet and for people. And I think more and more those things converge.
Interesting. Brilliant. Well, that was fascinating, Bronwyn. Thank you so much. It was, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for taking the time. Take care.
It's a pleasure. I look forward to next time.
Thank you, Bronwyn.
Okay, thanks. You too.
I'm a huge fan of Peter's Yard's sourdough crackers, and they go beautifully with cheese. All Peter's Yard crackers are made in small batches using quality natural ingredients and their sourdough starter, slowly fermented for 16 hours for award-winning flavour and crunch.
Online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
You're listening to A Slice of Cheese with Jenny Linford on Food FM. Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Tesco, Waitrose, Sainsbury's, Asda, Morrisons, Ocado, Amazon and specialist food retailers.
On this week's A Slice of Cheese, we're looking at something rather fundamental. We're looking at regenerative farming and cheese. I'm very happy to have with me today Lee Truelove, Head of Regenerative Farming at First Mill, and Leona MacDonald, Business Unit Director at Golden Hooves, which is closely connected to First Milk, as we'll discover. Hello, you two.
Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. I thought, Lee, we'd start with you, and perhaps, you know, perhaps you start with very first principles. Tell us, what is First Milk?
Jenny, First Milk is owned by dairy farmers right across the UK, so we're a cooperative. So all of our farmers have part ownership in the business. We have cheese factory in West Wales. We have another one in Cumbria. We also have farms in Scotland. Predominantly, we're B2B, so we sell an awful lot of really, really good cheese, you know, to other businesses. But we also supply liquid milk, not in a bottle, but liquid milk to what we call brokerage customers as well. So we've been in existence since 2000.
Okay. And tell me, you know, the title you have, Head of Regenerative Farming. What does that mean in a way, Lee? Because I think, you know, it's something we're hearing that phrase, regenerative farming, more and more nowadays. That's what I gather. It doesn't have a legal meaning as such, but it does, I'm guessing it does have meaning. There are things that are, they're regenerative practices. Is that right? Tell us more about that.
Yeah. It's a fascinating area and it's a developing area. So I think the first thing to say is that neither ourselves or I would suggest anybody else treats it as a definition that you've achieved it, you've finished. So the whole point about being regenerative is it's a continual journey, a journey of discovery, but hopefully a journey of achievement. And I think it started as a farming term, but now we're thinking about it in a more broader life term. So, you know, social aspects, community aspects, as well as what's happening, you know, with the soil. And I think that the starting point is, you know, can we leave things better? Can we improve things compared with how we might have started? Go to the soil. Are we improving soil? Soil organic matter, soil biology, soil health. It doesn't matter, if you like, what our actions are. What are the outcomes? Mm-hmm. So regeneration is all about the outcomes of more biodiversity, more soil health, hopefully more social cohesion within the rural economy and the rural community. So, you know, are we on an improving process? And I think that's as good a definition as you can have, rather than getting hung up in very sort of minutiae of actions.
And what are some of the practical things then? So First Milk, it's a co-op, so you have all these farmers. Are they interested in regenerative farming then? Is this something that they value and want to take part in?
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, 96% of our farmers are actively implementing, I think it's around 160,000 different regenerative actions. Mm. So there's a mass sort of achievement at scale there. I think it's worth saying that, you know, our journey started about 4 to 5 years ago, where, you know, essentially one of the principles of regenerative farming is, can we farm as much as possible mimicking some of the things that exist in nature? So can we work with nature rather than against nature? So the first thing about the UK, and in particular the sort of main areas we source milk from, is that they're some of the best grass growing, forage growing areas in the whole world. You know, we have sometimes a little bit too much rain, but we do have rain, and you know, water scarcity is an issue on a global front, isn't it?
Yes.
So we have rain, we have good soils, we have a lot of experience. So predominantly these areas, if you think about West Wales, you think about Cumbria, I think about the west coast of Scotland, they're not well adapted to producing arable grain. You know, these are grassland areas. Mm-hmm. They've been grassland areas, you know, for hundreds of years, possibly millennia. So, you know, how do we use what is natural, the rainfall and the topography and the climate, to produce, you know, the most sustainable food? And, you know, dairy and livestock are actually, you know, a really big part of all of that. So that's the starting point. And then, mm-hmm. you know, the regenerative principles are uniform globally, which, you know, there's five main principles. We would say the first one is livestock integration. And that's actually, there's a real good connection there with Golden Hooves, because the idea of livestock integration is that all land actually needs livestock to be truly healthy, which, you know, may be a slight, you know, slight amount of controversy there. So I think if you take it back again to how was soil created, we sometimes forget that you know, soil is not just a mixture of rock that's been pounded down by glaciers and we end up with soil. Soil is essentially a living product. It's very, very diverse, and it's organic matter. That's what soil is. It's not uh-huh. it's not just an erosion of rock. Mm. So you need life to create soil, and that life over millennia has actually been grazing animals that have moved through the landscape and grazed vegetation. So in a forest, you tend to get leaf matter, and obviously that builds soil organic matter. Whereas, you know, the world had massive plains. So if we take the plains of America, you know, nobody knows quite how many million bison there were, but, yeah, you know, certainly, probably, you know, certainly over 100 million bison, and some of them were in herds of 2 or 3 million migrating naturally from the south to the north over thousands of years. You know, I think it's beyond doubt that they created the soils of the prairies.
Right.
Likewise, caribou in Asia, likewise wildebeest in Africa, etc. So some of the richest soils that we rely upon for food today were built by ruminants. So right. The first principle of regenerative farming to sort of answer that is, mm-hmm. is obviously livestock integration.
Fantastic. So you were linking that to Golden Hooves then. I think that's where we were discussing. You talked about the principles.
Yeah, that's right, because you know, livestock, especially as it's, you know, food production, as it's become, you know, industrialized, I think that journey is probably at least 70 years old since World War II. We've become, you know, ever more perhaps efficient, but ever more industrialized. And, you know, that's the tension, isn't it, in food today. and agriculture. So, we would say that having animals outside grazing is mm-hmm. is better for the animals. It enables the animals to have a more diverse diet because they can, within reason, they can pick and choose what they eat. But what we now know about soil biology, things like mycorrhizal fungi and billions of bacteria, so there's more life within a teaspoon of soil than there is humans on Earth. You'd find 7 billion organisms within healthy soil. That they've evolved, all of that ecosystem has evolved with ruminants pulsing the soil. So the hoof action, mm-hmm. the manure, and indeed the sort of biting and grazing action, the biodiversity of soil has actually evolved over thousands of years to be stimulated by that. Uh-huh. So if the animals never, if we cut the grass and take it to the cows, which mm-hmm. we have to do certain times of the year when it's really, really wet or really, really cold, but if the animals never see the soil, then they never see the golden hooves, and the biology isn't stimulated in the same way.
That's fascinating. We should actually sort of move on to golden hooves and discuss that. So golden hooves is, you mentioned that you had cheese factories, Lee. Perhaps we should switch to Leona. Hello, Leona, waiting there patiently. Tell us what golden hooves is, Leona, and its relationship to First Milk.
Yeah, sure. So I think, as Leah said, and he probably could talk for hours because there's so much exciting work that First Milk are doing, we've got a massive story to tell, haven't we? I mean, if you think about that, 160,000 interventions every year, over 700 farms, there's over 4,000 kilometres of hedgerows that need looking after, there's waterways, there's, you know, all of that carbon that we're sequestering and looking into at the moment through that data capture, which we believe that we've got one of the largest data capture amounts in the world. You know, we're really working at that. We've got a story to tell. And so we were trying to work out, you know, how do we tell that story? Because every single farm that's working towards regenerative farming principles deserves to be celebrated. And we've got almost 700. So we were trying to find a way to share it and to bring that, keep the momentum with our farmers, mm-hmm. but also to share the pride and to share our absolute belief that we can leave the world a better place. So we started off with the Golden Hooves vending machines on farm a couple of years ago. So just as people coming out of the pandemic, there were some syrups in there for milkshakes. So if you go on your half an hour walk out or whatever it was at the time and get yourself some milk, some milkshakes, there might have been some local produce also in the machine. And it was a great way for us to get people to farm, to taste the milk and to kind of that full connection, you know, the farm-to-fork connection. And we were able to tell our story to a degree in that way, but we wanted to take it further. So we do have a responsibility, I think, as well, which is, you know, when you think about the fact that almost 72% of our countryside is in the custody of farmers, you know, we've got a responsibility and the need to share that needed to be greater than just a few on-farm vending machines. Just as we were trying to think about that vehicle, how can we do it? Our cheese that's made at our Haverford West Creamery in West Wales was amazingly and just so wonderfully awarded the Supreme Champion at the Global Cheese Awards in 2022. So a block cheddar winning Supreme Champion. So where we were thinking, well, we've got this amazing story to tell. We've got clearly an absolutely delicious product. And what is the most widely eaten cheese in the country, loved by everybody of every age? It's a cheddar. So it was a bit of one of those light bulb moments, really. And that's how it started. As Lee touched upon, the name comes from the fact that we have a really strong belief, and now lots of evidence is starting to build, that by those wonderful golden hooves on our cows across our farms, up and down the land, we are going to be leaving the world in a better place. And so we wanted to celebrate them. And that's sort of where the name came from, really.
And you say regenerative on the cheese packet, don't you?
Yeah, that's our strapline. Deliciously regenerative, yeah.
I mean, I think it's interesting in a way that you're picking on that aspect of what you do as the one you want to focus on for consumers, given that in a way that, you know, even though regenerative is a word that we're now seeing more in the food world, it's not perhaps a word that's out there a lot, you know, in the ordinary world, in the non-food world. So you're sort of championing an idea, I suppose. So when did you launch Golden Hooves Cheddar? Last year, was that right? 2023?
Yeah, we launched the cheddar last April, and we launched the mature and the vintage came out in September. And we're looking at a Red Leicester also coming through in the spring.
Okay. Yeah.
And yeah, you're right in that, Jenny. It is perhaps an unusual aspect on food, but as I say, it's one we're really passionate about. And making sure that food production, and particularly food production here in the UK, is considered, and that we do celebrate everybody that's trying to do something a little bit better every day. And that's really the regenerative mindset, isn't it?
From the sort of dairy farming point of view, what are some of the regenerative practices? I'm guessing, you know, you have a food aspect to what you're doing, a food and drink aspect. So I'm guessing the quality of the milk is an issue. Do you feel that regenerative farming practices have a positive impact on the milk that your members are producing? And could you give me perhaps an example of you know, a regenerative farming practice that does directly impact on the quality of the milk?
Yeah, of course, Jenny. I think the starting point for some of this, why we chose regenerative farming, is that, you know, there's big debate in food, isn't there, and big debate in life in general about carbon intensity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, carbon intensity is actually only one of the challenges we have to meet. So, you know, there's a biodiversity crisis out there. There's obviously a human health crisis. And we wanted to look at the whole subject of food and farming more holistically. And that's what regenerative farming does, because it brings together lots of these principles. So let's give two really clear examples of the things we encourage our members to do. So one of them is not just to graze, but to rotationally graze. And the term sometimes is used is mob graze. So the mob grazing is to allow the land to recover as long as possible after that initial day or 2 days of grazing. So again, that mimics nature. If you think of a migrating herd, they don't stay somewhere for months on end. They're always on the move, aren't they? So you know, we've got guidelines for our members to say, graze a field for 2 days and leave it rest for 21 or even 30 days before you come back. So that can be structured. And we've got a mapping package. So there's 100,000 hectares of land within First Mill. And all of that is individually mapped, every single field. And our members choose these interventions for every field. So, you know, the amount of data and the amount of overview that we've got. I could go through many, but the only one I'll cover off again now with you, the sort of second most impactful thing, is species diversity. Because just to eat grass and grass alone is obviously not very, very diverse for the cow's diet, but isn't very diverse in terms of soil structure, different rooting depths, different colonies of bacteria and fungi on every single root. So we encourage them to have much more diverse species, legumes like clover, you know, herbs and more broadleaf plants such as chicory and plantain, so that we have an environmental benefit, we have an animal benefit in terms of diverse diet, but any of that's more nutrient density also in the milk. So there's a food benefit.
Would your members actually then plant in order to get that sort of range of different species? Are they planting legumes, planting chicory, or how does that come about then?
Yeah, definitely they're doing that. So we're tracking an improvement in species diversity every year. You know, we're into our third year now of regen plans. But also we're asking them to perhaps identify the species they've got in some traditional pasture. So, you know, 2/3 of our land is actually permanent pasture, and some of that won't have been disturbed for a generation or two, in terms of the farmer knows that, you know, that land has been in pasture for as long as their lifetime. But there tends to be much more species rich diversity there than you know, you could see it sort of just a glance. So helping them to understand some of the sort of natural species on their farm, as well as what they could introduce.
Yeah, fascinating. And so, Leona, just go back to the cheese. So you have, you know, as I say, a very nice cheddar, which I've tried myself. How is the reception? How is Golden Hooves Cheddar going? Perhaps tell us first, where would people find Golden Hooves, and where are you selling it?
Yeah, we're really aiming at the speciality market, so independent farm shops, delis, that kind of thing, doorstep deliveries. Yeah, we're not at this stage looking to to move into the sort of multiples. We feel we've got, as I said, that story to tell, and we feel that we want to, you know, be in control of that story. You mentioned a moment ago about the word, you know, regenerative being used more and more. So we want to be at the forefront of that and to control that message a little bit as well before it becomes, you know, a misused term perhaps. So that's our main target. And also I think it's important for us, you know, as you heard, we could talk for hours about this, but we've set some really high standards for ourselves with regards to what we deem as regenerative and where we want to set ourselves. And I think it's really important for everybody to understand what they get when they buy a Golden Hooves product, in that it is exactly what we say it is. So, you know, with First Milk and all of the work that Lee and the rest of the team have been doing, the farmers and the cooperative were awarded the King's Award for Enterprise for Sustainable Development last year. We're a B Corp certified business. Golden Hooves itself has just been named as the only dairy brand in the top 200 ethical brands in the country. Awesome. And even with Zena, we've got these awards. So as well as the cheese awards, there's the sustainability awards. And then even within our own industry, you know, the speciality sector, Jenny, which I know obviously you focus a lot on, you know, to win new product of the year at speciality and fine food awards was amazing. And that's really based on the fact that we are creating a great product for the speciality market. And it has integrity. You know, we really are doing all of the things that we say we're doing.
How is it selling? Are consumers enjoying it? Are they buying it then?
They're loving it. Yeah. When they try it, it's amazing. Yeah. I'm here with one of our distributors today, actually, and they did a sampling with the sales team. And honestly, it was wolfed down. It was incredible. But getting the regenerative message across is the most important thing, and for people to understand it, because it is a bit of a mindset change, isn't it? Organic or some of the other accreditations are quite well boxed. You know, people understand them. This is more, as we said, as Lee mentioned, a holistic way of thinking about always being better for the planet, animals, people, better for our food production, ultimately, hopefully better for profit for businesses too. So it is a different message to get across, but it's we're having a lot of fun doing it. And I think we're absolutely on a mission.
I was sort of fascinated to see a cheese being sold in that way, actually. I just thought that was very, very interesting. And of course, Lee, it does. Cheese is a food, which is so connected to the soil, so directly connected because it comes from milk, and where does milk come from, you know, and what is milk affected by? It's affected by what the cows eat and how they live, how they're looked after. So it does have a very powerful food. So interesting to see a cheese doing that. So brilliant. Well, thank you both so much. It was really fascinating. Yeah, I wish you all the best with it. Thank you, Lee, and thank you, Leona.
Thank you, Jenny.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Thank you so much for listening to A Slice of Cheese. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have enjoyed it, it would be lovely if you could rate us on wherever you found this podcast. It will make such a difference to us. So I hope you'll enjoy us again. Thank you very much.